يقولون سلام سلام ولا هنا سلام.
You're listening to Middle East Analysis, a podcast series from the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales. A very warm welcome to the first Middle East Analysis podcast of 2013. Well, how exciting does it get? It gets this exciting because we are joined by the Bishop's Consultant on the Middle East North Africa region, Dr. Harry Hagopian. Harry, how are you?
Hello, James. Happy New Year to you. Happy New Year to all our listeners, both in England and Wales and across the world. And yes, I'm fine, remarkably fine for the start of a new year, despite a lot of traveling in the last couple of months. I seem to be fairly on top of things.
Now, I don't want to go down the broken record stakes again with my intro, so we're not really going to try and cover all the ground that has passed under the wheels since we last did a Middle East analysis, which you'll remember was a bit of a light one, wasn't it? Christmas feel to it.
It was. The last one we did was a sort of jingly, Christmassy, light kind of interview we had. So we haven't really spoken church or politics or the MENA region for the best part of 6-7 weeks.
Well, I mean, let's do that. But at the same time, without going over that old ground, we'll perhaps look ahead a bit now. So
okay.
It's less of a catch-up, more of a look forward. And I know a few stock phrases you may come out with when I ask you certain questions. So it's been 5 weeks or so. I'd like to talk a bit about Syria, not really just the internal and external displacement, the continuing defiance of President al-Assad. I'd also like to talk a little bit about Iraq and the continuing dispute, Kurds, central government. The Holy Land coordination that we organise ourselves as the Catholic Bishops Conference of England and Wales. Bishops Lang and Kenny over there in that region.
True.
That too. But should we start with Syria, Harry?
Let's do that. And you're absolutely right, James. It's the start of a new year. We've been off air for about 6-7 weeks in real terms. Therefore, we can't really go and cover all that happened in those long weeks. So maybe it's good to sort of gradually step back into a routine by talking a little bit broadly about the region and then gradually starting to focus on a few events and a few countries over the next few interviews.
Now, a colleague of mine said, all right, you've got Dr. Harry Hagopian in. Why don't you ask him whether 2013 is going to be the year that President al-Assad actually steps aside for a new Syria? And I think I know kind of how you might frame your answer to this one, but it's a fair enough question, isn't it?
It's a fair enough question. I think you're not the only one, and your colleague is not the only one who's asking it. So many people have been asking it over and over again. And in fact, they've been asking it for the past 2 years almost. When will he go? Will he go? In what way will he go? What will happen to Syria when he goes?
And this is a man that says he'll live and die in Syria, Harry.
And this is a man who has said time and again, and only recently at the Opera House in Damascus, that he's going to live, he's going to stay, he's going to die if death is what will happen. He even suggested, his deputy foreign minister Faisal Miqdad, in an interview only a day or so ago, said that, well, who knows, maybe President Bashar al-Assad will run for elections again in 2014 when his term comes to an end. So the world is full of unpredictable realities, James. And coming back to your question, will he still be there, or the question of your colleague, will he still be there at the end of 2013 or not? You know my standard answer to that, and you're smiling before I even give it to you. I'm not a prophet. I've never claimed to be a prophet. I only try to analyze the facts as I see them. And the more facts I see, the less I'm convinced of the analysis that I or anybody else is providing about the MENA region, because there is so much volatility, there is so much unexpected reality creeping into the region, regardless of the country you talk about, that it's almost impossible to say, oh, this is what will happen, this is what will not happen. But given what you said in your intro, the number of internally displaced, the casualties, the deaths, the refugees, which is a cumbersome reality, not only for Syria itself, but for Jordan, for Lebanon, for Turkey, even for Iraq and other countries, one would think that if we were living in a rational world, President Bashar al-Assad cannot stay there come the end of this year. But are we living in a rational world? What I will say is that there is one keyword or one buzzword that I will leave with you and with our listeners. The word is transition. In my opinion, and in the opinion of most analysts who are seriously involved with the region rather than just sitting in their chairs and pretending to understand the region, the word that is used is transition. Again, why? Everybody agrees that since the Americans and the Russians sat together in Geneva some months ago, they put together a framework for a transitional period that will lead to a new reality in Syria. Now, nobody disagrees with the fact that things have to move. What they disagree with is what is the meaning and definition of transition. If you look at what our own foreign secretary and what the West says, transition means that President Bashar al-Assad will have to relinquish his power, his presidency, and let a new person and a new interim government take over that will carry the country into the new reality post-elections, post a new constitution, a little bit like what has been happening or is now happening in, say, Egypt, say, Tunis, say, Libya. That is one understanding of transition. What other people like the Russians and the Iranians and certainly President Assad himself would say, transition has nothing to do with me leaving my presidency or my seat of power. It means I will be very much there, a part of the negotiations that will lead Syria into a new reality. Now, when you talk to me about that, and the Deputy Foreign Minister, Faisal Miqdad, whom I just referred to a couple of seconds ago, in his interview, he said, well, we're in a democracy. Who says that you can cross out one person to be part of the political process, even if it's a new political process, a new constitutional process, but you can include other people in? And in an ideal world, I would say, yes, if we're going to have elections, if we're going to have democracy, whatever your definition of democracy, and I don't believe in democracy the way it is defined in most writings, then I would say, yes, he's got a fair point. But that fair point withers away painfully when I think of the number of deaths, well over 60,000, the blood, the uncertainty, the destruction of the country. Two reports only that came out recently this week, one by Human Rights Watch and another one by IRC, both of them basically saying that the damage, the destruction, the deaths, the use of rape and violence against women and even men, all this has polarized the country so much so that what I think we're seeing now is a focus on transition, and what 2013 might do, broadly speaking, is to tease out the definition, the meaning of transition, and we can see which way it goes. Will it go the way Assad thinks transition goes, or will it go the way we think transition goes and the way the rebels who are fighting him in the country think too?
Now, transition is an interesting word, though, isn't it? Because you could look at Egypt, as you've mentioned, mm-hmm. and all the constitutional problems mm-hmm. at the tail end of the year. You can look at Iraq longer term. We'll mm-hmm. probably speak about Nouri mm-hmm. al-Maliki, the Prime Minister, mm-hmm. shortly. You know, whose version of transition? Is it any better long term? I mean, I think part of the problem is we sort of look to what is seen as a short-term end goal, i.e. in this case, President al-Assad stepping aside, without thinking, well, you know, how are things going to improve for the people? It's not just ending the killings, which obviously people want. It's the, you know, reconstruction or the moving forward. I mean, are we still short-term end goals with these things?
Of course. Well, one of the problems we're facing is that we actually thought that the whole Arab Spring, as it was initially called when we started our podcast on the uprisings, we used to call it Arab Spring until we realized that the season is too short for a whole series of uprisings. The problem we've had is that everybody, from analysts to politicians to writers to journalists, we've all thought this is a short-term goal. Have a few months of uncertainty, then things will change, we'll be in a different reality. We're suddenly realizing that this is going to take much, much longer before we actually see what is at the end of the tunnel. And in some cases, we're seeing the light or murmurs of light at the end of the tunnel. In other cases, we're not even seeing the light yet in the tunnel. But eventually, it's going to be a long process that will lead to change. And change is not only inevitable, but it also is necessary for the region, which is why I say that despite all the sacrifices, the deaths, the pain, all that makes me really feel for the region in so many different ways, I would say that it was time for this region to brace itself to these realities, get its pulse racing faster, so that we can actually move away from autocracy, from totalitarianism, into hopefully something where a sense of citizenship will emerge. That is very far off yet. It's a long-term goal. But we shouldn't stop or desist or play politics only for the sake of short gains. We should think a little bit long term, and we should hope that at the end of the day, when the killings stop, when the realities change, those realities will be conducive to giving the human being, every man, woman, and child, a voice, a being, as it were, in the region. If we can do that, fair enough. Are we there? No way. How far before we get there? No idea. When I talk to people in the region, it's remarkable, James, how they tell you so many people have died in all those countries, but certainly Syria by far outpaces any other country in terms of deaths during those uprisings. They tell you, yes, after all this, if nothing else, those deaths have made our uprisings and the change unstoppable. And in a sense, I agree with that. And so we, as a political world, but we also as a religious church world, we should accompany those changes, not oppose them, because it is not in our interest to do so at all.
Now, moving on to fights over ladders in Jerusalem. No, I'm only joking. You thought I was going there, didn't you? No, let's move on to Iraq now. I think we should. Nouri al-Maliki, Prime Minister, under pressure. The lens is focused on the dispute between the Kurds and the central government. We're not going to do news per se, but just bring us up to speed a little on Iraq.
Yeah, it's very interesting with Iraq. It's something that has caught my attention again. And funnily enough, in this Twitter world that I sometimes inhabit, I have noticed that there is so much about Syria. There is so much about Israel-Palestine. There's so much about Mali these days. But there's hardly anything about Iraq again. Although, in my opinion, Iraq is again one of the epicenters of what is happening in the region. And there are many reasons for that. One, Iraq is very much an active part in what's happening in Syria. It's a neighbor, it's got borders, refugees are slipping in and out of Iraq, fighters are slipping in and out of Iraq, military hardware is slipping in and out of Iraq into Syria. So that's one thing. The other thing that about Iraq as well, it's also a terrain for one of those competitions between Iran on the one hand and the West on the other. So that's also something that's happening. And thirdly, and perhaps most immediately, it's also a time when the Kurds, given what's happening in northeastern Syria with the Kurdish population, given the autonomy that Kurdistan or Iraqi Kurdistan has achieved ever since the toppling of Saddam Hussein, there is this idea of having a larger Kurdish reality up there. So that reality is superimposing itself upon a very dictatorial central government in Baghdad, where the Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki wants to be a Mark II Saddam Hussein in some ways and an open, benevolent dictator in other ways. So those disputes over, say, Kirkuk, which incidentally is claimed by both the Iraqi Arabs and the Iraqi Kurds, but it is also an area, interestingly enough, which has a lot of oil in it. So, of course, it becomes important. The disputed territories, the realities of what happens with government. And, of course, one thing that's complicated life in Iraq, in my opinion, and in those tensions between Kurds and Iraqi Arabs on the one hand, but also between Iraqi Sunnis and Iraqi Shiis on the other, is the fact that the president of Iraq, Talabani, who many people can write a lot of things about him, but one thing about him is that he was a man who had presence and charisma, and he was one of the mediators who pretty much helped hold things together amongst those different factions in Iraq. He's suffered a stroke. He's now in a hospital in Germany. And my assessment, again, with the small print that I'm not a prophet, that he's not going to be able to come back and reassume his role as president of Iraq. The fact that he's away makes Iraq even more volatile and more open to those different winds blowing from different directions. So what I would say in this podcast is, apart from Syria, let's keep Iraq and its communities, which incidentally also has a large Christian community of different confessions, in our prayers, but also in our scrutiny.
Well, one man who has been to Iraq on a number of occasions is Bishop William Kenny.
Indeed.
Now, Bishop William Kenny, Auxiliary Bishop of Birmingham, along with the chair of the International Affairs Department, Bishop Declan Lang, travelled to the Holy Land.
That they did.
For the Holy Land coordination, which, absolutely, of course, the Bishops' Conference over here is mandated to organise by the Holy See.
By the Vatican, yeah.
Now, you know, it covers some ground. It brings bishops from Europe and North America into the region. We've talked about the backdrop
to this
visit.
And even a priest from South Africa.
Indeed.
James, that to me is far more important, forgive me, bishops, but it's far more important than the other bishops from North America and Europe in one sense. This is a man who lived the apartheid regime. This is a man who knows where Africa was and where South Africa is today. And therefore, in a sense, I would have hoped that he would be a very, very exciting element in this Holy Land coordination delegation to the Holy Land, because he could compare and contrast.
Now, what would your assessment be of the coordination? Because, you know, again, we've talked about the context and the backdrop to it. It's, I suppose, somewhat limited in what it can achieve. But again, that word solidarity, it is a display of solidarity with the Christians of the region, with the people of the region.
You know, how could I try to reconcile two realities in the Holy Land? One reality is a political reality, and another one is a faith reality. The faith reality is because there are Israeli Jews, Palestinian Muslims, and Palestinian Christians sharing a very tiny sliver of land called the Holy Land. And even not the whole of the Holy Land, because if we take the biblical story, the Holy Land goes so far not only to Jordan, which it does, but it also goes to Syria, it even goes to Egypt. So in a sense, you've got that faith-based reality. But against that faith-based reality, there is a very cruel and relentless political reality. That political reality is one people occupies another. One land is occupied by another state. Palestinians are under occupation. And this is not Harry James sitting here and talking to you or giving you his point of view. This is what international law says. This is what United Nations Security Council resolution says. That's what the European Union and the United States administration say. So what I'm saying is nothing new and nothing earth-shattering. In that sense, you have those bishops and those priests and a few lay people every year doing their pilgrimage under the title of Holy Land Coordination to the Holy Land. And this is where it becomes woolly. Why does it become woolly? Are they people going there as politicians? If they are, that's not their mandate. If they aren't, then they're denying the reality of the land they're visiting. On the other hand, they've got the church-based, faith-based approach to it. going there in solidarity with the churches there. Bishop Declan Lang, in his interview with BBC Bristol and in his comments, has often said that he is there to stand in solidarity with the Christians and the churches and communities of the Holy Land. But it's more than that. As he also referred, it's an interfaith reality. Muslims, the dominant majority of Palestinians, Christians are much smaller in numbers, and of course Israel with its Jews of different colors and backgrounds. So bring the faith on one side and the politics on the other, then you realize why the Holy Land coordination sometimes feels a little bit like a strange element visiting from space, because which way do they turn? Which way do they rotate their interests? And I'll give you a simple example. If you read the final communique of the Holy Land coordination, which is something that comes at the end of every year's visit, and it is a heroic, wonderful effort. In a sense, it tries to encapsulate what they saw, what they did, and it tries to bring together the faith realities of solidarity, coordination, peacemaking, living together, fellowship, but it also brings into it little clips of political reality. For instance, in this year's communique, it talks about the wall. The wall being that ugly separation barrier that divides Palestinian communities from each other, let alone supposedly Israel from Palestine, in a way that is, in my opinion, inequitable and unjust. But it doesn't talk about settlements. So when I read that communique, I wonder, the most important issue is the issue of settlements. Why isn't that there? Probably because the bishops didn't want to go the political way. That is where those compromises are done. But those compromises and those difficulties are difficulties that are encountered by many, many other groups, because the whole makeup of the Holy Land makes it so difficult to deal with, and therefore it explains why for 60 years we haven't yet managed to resolve this conflict we call so grandiosely the Israeli-Palestinian one.
Harry, thanks ever so much for your analysis, as always. Good introduction to the year. Many more podcasts to come that will hone in, I think, on some of these areas.
I think this was more of a general broad view and a way for both of us to wish all our listeners a happy new year to them all. May 2013 be three H's: H for health, H for hope, and H for happiness.
And the fourth H for Hagopian.
Thank you.
Right. There you go. Just a few little catch-ups now. If you want to follow us online, you can do that. The home of Middle East analysis is catholicnews.org.uk. You can also catch us on iTunes if you want to download your podcast that way. Twitter, Harry mentions it a lot because he's loving it at the moment. That's at Harry Hagopian, or us here, the church, at Catholic EW. And we'll be catching you many times in the new year. Thanks for listening to Middle East Analysis.